a wonderful nurse. When I was a second year resident, we had a patient who was very aggressive in a wheelchair, quadriplegic, but would jump out of his wheelchair every now and then to grab an attendant and choke him. But he also had bad tremors. So he was on the beta blockers for the tremors. And it was up to 600 milligrams a day total dose of propranolol. Didn't affect his blood pressure, but it helped his tremors. And oh, by the way, it also helped his aggression. So I came in, and then the deal was he would go out to the nursing home all the time and come back to the hospital, to the inpatient hospital where we were, because they cut his beta blockers. Because they said, no one can be on this high of a dose, right? So I come in spanking new and with all my, you know, I knew about new drugs. We were using lithium and all kinds of other things for aggression. And the nurse said, well, the head nurse, you have to get the beta blockers back up, you know, because that's what helped, that's what got him out of here. And so I resisted and tried everything else first, and then finally agreed and pushed the dose up, and magically his aggression stopped. Not that he was asleep, not that, you know, it just stopped. His tremors stopped, all that. So I said, wow, this is something. And then we had a bunch of people on the unit that were also aggressive. There was one developmentally disabled woman who would start screaming about 2:30 because the staff changed and was going to miss her staff. And she would just stand in the middle of the day room and start screaming. So I said, well, if the beta blockers work for this guy, maybe it'll work for her. So I started her on 30 or 40 milligrams, and it really was too much for her because her blood pressure wouldn't stand it. So we used a lower dose, and lo and behold, her screaming stopped. So then I generalized it. We had a lot of inpatients who, back in those days, who were called schizophrenic, that were really autistic. I mean, we're talking the 80s, okay, 70s, 80s. That's what happened. And so I wrote a paper, American Journal of Psychiatry, and then got a bunch of grants, and then studied. I tried to study schizophrenics in patients, but there wasn't enough data. We couldn't get the data. But who collected the data on inpatients? You got it. The people that were running around with clipboards doing cognitive behavioral training, that's what we call it today, on autistic patients. So I started working in that field. And I was one of like four psychiatrists in the country that was interested in autism. So I became a big deal in the autism world and eventually got Temple Grandin as my patient. Yeah. And wrote a paper with her, was on TV with her early on because she was just coming into ascendancy. So I became really involved. Really because, oh geez. This isn't hooked up to that. Anyway, so that led me to get a bunch of grants for new beta blockers as they were coming out, and so I was trying them. And then I was convinced that there was a peripheral action because of the tremors, because decreasing the effect of the sympathetic nervous system had a play on the brain. So lowering the blood pressure, lowering the pulse, but also lowering what we call muscle tension, the tension, the hyperaroused state. And I wrote a bunch of papers and about that and saw that yes, there we go. Then, thank you. Then, So looking at the targets is where the beta blockers were working. One of them, that not just the blood pressure, the pulse and all that, but also what's called the muscle spindles. These are areas in our muscles that set the resting tension of muscles. And if you all have hyper-aroused patients, well, that's what the beta blockers do. And that's one of the reasons I used, at the end there, I was using peripherally acting beta blockers to prove the idea that it wasn't the brain, because we, in the early 80s, all people were talking about is brain, medicine to the brain. That was it. Well, I was saying, okay, medicine to the body, because I saw these work on akathisia, which is a side effect of the antipsychotics that really led to a lot of aggression and self-abusive behavior in people who were on high doses of neuroleptics. Did all kinds of conferences, et cetera, and papers and whatnot. But the point being is that we knew that that by using something that worked in the body, and it was a big deal back in those days because people weren't looking at the body in terms of medicine. And so it got me involved with autism. And I continue to be very involved in autism and work at a place in central New York called the Center for Discovery. I'd go out there monthly and involved with them, their staff, and have a research project going for the past 4 years. And the Center for Discovery has 365 adolescent autistic patients. Half of them inpatients, half of them day patients, but very aggressive, very much failures at all other institutions. And there it's helped direct the program to really focus on changing the lifestyle. We're blessed with having a 1,000-acre farm where they grow their own food. The clients, work in the fields, work getting eggs in the morning, work with the pigs and the cattle and all of that. So they're outside and they're moving. They're moving. We have actigraphs and Fitbits and all that on them. And some of them are moving 65% of the time that they're awake. Not just during the day, but while in the evening, they have running groups, they have walking groups, and those that can participate, Zumba, yoga. It's really an amazing place. And people go there, can't believe that this is happening. But what we see is we were able to withdraw a lot of the piles and piles of medicine that they're on. They become more socially active, it's really a wonderful scene to see, okay, if you change the lifestyle, if you get them eating a decent diet, if you get them to sleep, because we focus on sleep a lot, and yesterday we were talking about GI, or you were, we have all these specialists from on the research team from all over the country, and we have, I call her the world's expert on poop, on constipation. You were talking about a patient yesterday. Well, so it's all that is directed to get our patients healthy, physically healthy, as they can be. And we see a drop in their aggression, self-abusive behavior, an improvement in their socialization and sociability, as well as their ability to learn. Now, one of the things that I've always been interested in since I got into this whole area with autistic kids and people in general is balance and coordination. Now, we know that most autistic, or no, not most, but over 60% of autistic and Asperger kids have trouble with balance and coordination. They do. Why? Well, we don't know. We do know. I mean, early studies show that looking at their cerebellum, a good proportion of these autistic people have abnormal cerebellum. In 1990, we started looking at the PET scans, because there was a postmortem study showing that the cerebellum had abnormal cells in the vermis. And so we began to think, okay, the cerebellum had something to do with the weird behavior, socialization, mood regulation. And now, today, move up to the present day, we know a lot about the cerebellum. It's not just about balance and coordination physically. It's balance and coordination of our brain systems, our social system, our emotional response, our reading system. All those are at play. And so yesterday I talked about how our frontal cortex developed as we became, went through the hunter-gatherer period. But you look here at this 4 million years of evolution and you see the growth of the frontal cortex as well as where the cerebellum sits. That grew as well. Those are the two parts of the brain that really expanded as we became more human. And it's only, as I say, it's only been the last 20 years or so that we've really been focused on the cerebellar frontal connection. And that's important. So when you train the balance and coordination for your kids, they get better at thinking, at socializing, at attending, at being comfortable. They decrease the noise. So we have a project out there where we're working with them to train up their cerebellum. We have a balance room where all the kids go through every day, not every day, maybe twice, two or three times a week, and walking on planks and being on the BOSU ball and doing other things to improve their balance and coordination. Well, they did a study of 19 kids just this past year. These 19 kids could walk along a plank and move along a plank with pretty good balance. However, 18 out of 19 couldn't stand heel to toe. They couldn't stand heel to toe. So then we instituted an intensive training of their cerebellum or their balance and coordination system. It's not just the cerebellum, obviously, but it's the core and everything. And what we found was that they could, after about 6 months of training, they could stand heel to toe. But, oh, by the way, there was a drop in what we called their disruptive behaviors. There was an improvement in their socialization, improvement in their learning capacity, improvement in their attention. Because now we know the cerebellum plays a role in almost all of our higher brain functions. And this is the area that was a little bit abnormal, the vermis, the connection of the cerebellum to the rest of the brain. That's in the 80s or 70s, actually, when they looked at postmortems of autistic people, areas of the brain that were abnormal, and this was one of them. We now know that it plays a role in attention deficit disorder. 15, 20 years ago now, studies were showing, hey, cerebellum is a bit odd, a bit different in our ADHD kids. Doing the test to inhibit their response, they were pretty lousy at, and this part of the brain is involved with that. And so if you begin to train up this part of the brain, they get better at inhibiting. And in fact, at McLean Hospital in Boston area, they've been doing studies and all the fancy scans to show that this improving the balance and coordination improves their attention. And this is an area of the brain that has a lot of dopamine nerve cells. So our stimulants that we use also work in the cerebellum to make it work better. So one of the pieces of the attention system that we've just really focused on now is this balance and coordination. And so, and we know that more than 33% now, probably 40% of kids that we look at who have ADD also have balance and coordination problems. And if you can treat them, and it's a take home for the parents, a take home for the kids, a take home for the teachers. If you get them trained physically to improve their balance and coordination, to focus on it, and one of the best is this, is jump rope, of course, and then you have the balance board and the BOSU ball, but there's lots of different ways that kids can participate. And we have out there, we're using the video game to improve your balance and all that. And the kids love it because it's a video game and they improve pretty quickly. And it helps their behavior, it helps their comfort level. And I wrote a chapter in one of my books a while ago talking about MIT students who have a lot of autism, a lot of Asperger syndrome in that group, or they did, and they still do, and a lot of problems with balance and coordination. And one of the things I learned from them, because they're really taught me so much, is that they couldn't dance. They couldn't dance. They took dancing lessons, they took acting lessons on their own. I mean, this is natural history kinds of stuff, because they knew they needed to improve that. Well, if they couldn't dance, they couldn't do the social dance, because they couldn't figure out how to talk, what distance to stand, in a relationship, all that. And you're shaking your heads because you have Asperger kids, autistic kids that have that trouble. And by getting their physical balance and coordination and physicality boosted up, you really can change their lives. And by focusing on their physical training, you can make a huge difference. A book came out of the Center for Discovery for those of you who see a lot of autistic kids or Asperger kids have a lot of stress. Terry Hamlin, who's the head of Center for Discovery, wrote this book, and it's a very popular book amongst people that treat Asperger and autistic kids, and it's the Oregon Center for Child Development, which sees a lot of autistic kids in Oregon. They give it to every new parent coming in because it's ways of helping your kids be less stressed. And that's what you want when you want to improve the lives of your children. We know a lot that motor problems predict the severity. Early evaluation, fine and gross motor skills predict the problems with behavior and early on. So if we can start getting these little guys and gals to develop balance and coordination early, that will have an effect throughout their lives. So we have all kinds of gizmos, and we were talking about this yesterday about using the urban rebounder, and another center has their own kind of rebounder, but it improves their balance at challenge, and they like it. Sometimes they like it too much, because some of our autistic kids never want to get off the trampoline. But for others that have trouble with the balance, that is so helpful. And I wrote about the center in the book, this book, Go Wild, where I looked at our hunter-gatherer genes. basically, how did we evolve, and what are our genes telling us to do? And so we went back and learned a lot about how we used to live and what kind of diet we had. We didn't have, 50 foods to choose from. We had 400 foods to choose from. So variety was a spice of life. We certainly didn't have concentrated glucose in sugar or in starches. We had them occasionally. And we were moving, as I mentioned yesterday, we were moving up to 10 miles a day. That's 40,000 steps on your Fitbit, not 10,000 steps. And we're expecting, as we come out of the womb, to play, which I'll talk about soon, to come out and play. And we're not doing that with our kids today. They're playing virtually. And sleep is a big part of what we expect to do from our genetic perspective. But the thing that's happened with our changing world is that no one's sleeping enough because of our devices. Being outside, one of the greats at Harvard wrote about the biophilia. How we need to get out, and we have a natural need to be out in nature. And it's really important to us. Mindfulness, being mindful of who we are, where we are, being connected, and working and developing small tribes. Also, what we do at the center and what we know from the literature is that dance is important, is an important exercise. The Zumba is great for your kids too. All kinds of dance can help your ADD kids. We learned that early on. The dance, gymnastics, martial arts are great recommendations to the parents to get their kids involved with, for the ADD kids and for the autistic kids, because it involves really being fit, but also really focusing. So it's not just about getting your heart rate up and getting your muscles moving, as we talked about yesterday, but it's also focusing, getting the moves correct, and that leads to positive exercise engagement. What we see when, the big move in, or one of the big findings recently is looking at people that are exercising, they're more likely to be involved with the people they're exercising with. And yesterday I talked about a little bit about using exercise to decrease aggression, temper tantrums. And one of the first studies that we did was going into a group of schools, one in Charleston, South Carolina that I mentioned, but another, the first one in Kansas City, Missouri, which is an inner city school with kids that were very underprivileged in their elementary school, had their principal begin the day with 30 minutes of running and calisthenics. What they saw over the course of the first year is that their scores went way up on their what's called a fitness gram, measuring their different levels of fitness. But what went down was disciplinary referrals. Over the year, 63% drop in discipline problems, an improvement in attendance. This is what we see when we enter a school and begin to get them to add daily exercise into the classroom or before school. Not only is the first thing is a drop in impulsive behavior, the second thing is that the kids want to come to school. There's a story in the news years ago now out of Tampa, Florida, where a second grader was arrested for the second time driving himself to school. Okay, second time. Why? He didn't want to miss PE. He wanted to get to school for PE. So it shows the sort of natural need for us to move and to play. And I mentioned this yesterday. There's on my website, johnrady.com, there's a video called Brain Games about a school in Saskatchewan, Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, where it's a sort of an end-of-the-road school for kids, a lot of First Nation kids, a lot of kids from really troubled backgrounds, all of them having learning problems, all of them diagnosed with attention problems, in this classroom, a special ed classroom. And so the special ed teacher had read Spark, and so she said, well, I'm going to do something about this, and got a donation of these treadmills and put them in her classroom. So they started the day with 30 minutes of exercise. Now, of course, no one did it at first. They weren't, you know, they just sat there. And then one kid started to, you know, that was the drill. One kid started to do it, and then the teacher got up and did it. So she was up there walking and running for 30 minutes, and then eventually all the kids participated. But it was Canadian Broadcasting Company did a 6-month look at these kids and found really remarkable changes in a lot of them. All of them improved on their reading scores, on their math, but also on their attendance, and a decrease in their nasty behavior, but also in their socialization. They were able to socialize with one another and be more reasonable. So also there, I mentioned this yesterday, but to focus on it, one of the ways that we treat kids in the classroom or at home who are causing trouble, disruptive in the school or at home, is that we give them a timeout. Well, a principal out in Colorado said, look, I've developed this program called Time In. When my kids are being disruptive, I send them outside, or the teacher sends them outside of the classroom on an old exercise bike they had in the hallway, and they had to do 5 minutes on the exercise bike. And then after they did that, they were ready to come back into school. And then they developed a whole room. As my wife said last night, some schools call it the Rady Room, to where they send the kids to do a machine or a game for 5 minutes to get themselves, get active, get their body active. And what that does is not just burn off energy. What that does is it turns on their brain and it allows them to naturally put the brakes on their amygdala, their impulses, so they can come back in. And what he's found over years and what we find now is that people say, well, they just want to act up to get to the exercise machine. Well, it's not true. What they really want to do is participate with their other mates in the classroom. So this is what happened. So you don't see this kind of thing anymore. This has to be an old photograph. Why? The lawyers. This is the problem. The mother would say, oh my God, it's too dangerous. Somebody was talking yesterday and asked the question about the extreme sports. Well, that's what we used to do. Not jumping off the top of a roof like some of our ADD kids, but and you want to be somewhat reasonable, but this is not, wasn't abnormal when I was growing up. Although that wasn't me. But just look at their joy. And we know that play is going away in our lives. Physical, interactive play, creative play, right? It's going away. Well, we know that play is important, when, especially for our kids. When they come out of the womb, they're expecting to play genetically, if you think about it. We evolve to play because we learn so much in play. And we have all kinds of studies now because we're looking at play as an intervention for the brain. Something that happens as the kids evolve. If you stop play from occurring, their brains are smaller. They're dumber. And they end up being the bullies or the bullied. And we know this from animal studies and from human studies, that this happens. If you retard play in animals, they do not fit in. They are the oddball. Because not, and it's from the brain's perspective, but also in the learning perspective in the brain. They learn the social cues. They learn the social emotional training. And if you don't have that, then the kid's an oddball, doesn't know how to do it. and a book that I recommend to you, it's an old book now, but Stuart Brown wrote a book on play, is another psychiatrist out in Northern California. And he's written a lot about how play is so crucial to our lives. Now, we know that in looking at the brain, that the play circuits in the brain start way back in the midbrain area and go up to into our limbic system. But they're very primitive. They're actually more primitive, they're more basic than even our hunger response. The joy circuit is more primitive than our feeding circuit. So, and this was illustrated by this event that occurred up in Manitoba on the tundra. Some years ago now, the fellow got a new pack of sled dogs, was very proud of them, took along the sled dogs to train them on the tundra, brought a photographer because he was really excited about them. So the first day out there, along about dusk, they were having their meal, and in comes running this 1,200-pound male, starving polar bear. They thought, uh-oh, it's dinner time for the polar bear. He's going to eat his natural enemy, the wolf. But what happened? This guy here was said to be the dumbest of the group. Instead of being afraid and defensive, he got into what's called the universal play position, which is back bowed, tail up, wagging, mouth open, but fangs covered. So what happened? This polar bear coming in with hair up, ready to charge, ready to kill, decided, oh, an invitation. And they began to play. So in other words, this is something that really is so primitive that we need to be playing. And you know, there's all kinds of illustrations of this in nature, but you know, and I'll never forget, I was once in Hawaii and went to Punahou, where Obama was educated, in a very fancy school. And I observed their recess for their elementary school. They had incredible equipment, you know, houses to climb in and all this other stuff. Well, the kids in each class would come out and come running out to the playground, go through those things, but you know, through the different devices that they had and all, but very quickly they would gather together and start playing hopscotch and four square and soccer. That's what they wanted to do. They wanted to interact with each other. And a study now years ago out of Mount Sinai Medical School looked at 12,000 kids across the country looking at the effect of recess on the kids. And what they found was that 30 minutes a day seemed to be the tipping point. If you had less than 30 minutes, you had trouble with the kids in the classroom. 30 minutes divided up, however, and these were kids up to sixth grade. and they also found that it didn't matter whether you had all these fancy gizmos for the kids to play in, the fancy houses, fancy structures. The best recess were those that had the least equipment, because it forced them to be creative, to make up their games and involve each other in their games. And this led to a decrease in behaviors in the classroom, an improvement in focusing, and improvement in time on attention, time on task. Because what happens when we move or when we play is that we light up, we turn on this front part of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, the last part of our brain to evolve. And that part of the brain is involved with putting the brakes on impulses, also doing all the intellectual things that we need to do in life. Understanding, organizing, all the so-called executive functions, including attention and working memory. So if we had a pill that was an exercise pill, you'd all take it, because all the benefits are both for the body, the physical, but also for the brain. It wouldn't be on the shelves very long. And every now and then you hear, oh, we have an exercise pill coming. No, can't do it. Too much going on, because we have to get our hormones and our neurotransmitters to the brain where the action is, and we metabolize that. So one of the big findings that we have, and I talked a bit about yesterday, is we create, and when we move, we create this substance called BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. This is what I call Miracle-Gro for the brain, that we get when we exercise, when we move, when we run, when we play, and when we exercise. And BDNF does all kinds of great stuff. It increases our plasticity. It increases our ability to make new brain cells, which we make every day. And also exercise improves collateral circulation, so it's protective against injury and stroke, and so forth. And that's BDNF. We know that it's now important for anxiety and mood regulation. For instance, when the drug companies now, and not many are doing it, looking for a new antidepressant. We used to think, okay, a new antidepressant, what are they going to look at? Initially, it was increase the concentration of norepinephrine and dopamine. Well, then it became serotonin with Prozac, right? Serotonin. But now they want to find new drugs that increase BDNF. That's the target in the lab, because BDNF is a regulator for the brain in terms of emotions. So it helps with anxiety, with mood regulation, with impulses. It's it's the queen of all growth factors in the brain. It also promotes learning. It is the key factor in making us more motivated, present, and ready to address life. Now, what we know when we move, when we exercise, when we play, when we're challenging our muscles, we break muscle fibers. That's how our brain grows. When we stress that's how our muscles grow. When we stress our body, we stress our muscles and our bones. And what happens is we break muscle fibers, and then we send out repair factors and recovery factors. All these factors, IGF, FGF2, all these other things, and then VEGF, which we make more nerve cells, more capillaries. Basically, these cells, these moieties are released to help repair and recover, to say, okay, you damaged your muscle, and so you need more muscle fibers, you need more blood flow, you need more insulin to brought in. Well, these factors all go up and affect the brain, also promoting the effect of on our immune system, which is really important, and increases the release of endorphins and endocannabinoids. You all know what endorphins are, or endogenous morphine. You probably have heard recently we're getting into the endocannabinoids. The cannabinoids, ring a bell? Cannabis, well, we have a very distributed and very healthy and a whole lot of our own cannabinoids in our body. We make it in our body and in our brains, just like the endorphins. So the endorphins is endogenous morphine, and the cannabinoids endogenous marijuana. And if you exercise, you raise those hormones to help. What do they help do? They help prevent the pain response peripherally and centrally, that is at the muscle fiber itself. So when you're starting to do a new exercise and you're really stretching and breaking muscle fibers, you can continue because you're right locally, you're getting a bolus of morphine and cannabis, or those factors that are like morphine because they block the pain fibers. Also, it goes up to our brain and has an effect centrally, as well as released centrally, to help us feel good. And today, when we did the initial work with the marathoners, we were looking at the endorphins. So you all heard about endorphins and exercise, and people feeling crappy say, I got to get to the gym to raise my endorphins. Well, that's going to be changing. It's to raise your endocannabinoids as well as your endorphins. So we can affect the brain many different ways. Today we used to think about using medication. We have tons of medicines that affect the brain, but we also know that exercise does similar kinds of things. Exercise increases our dopamine, norepinephrine, and serotonin almost immediately. So my standing up here, walking up here, increases the effectiveness of my attention system, of my prefrontal cortex, by about 7%. Those of you who are old enough to remember or know that in the 60s and 70s, one of the treatments for dyslexia was having the kids stand and read. Why? We didn't know why. They were just better. Well, what happened, what we know now, is that by standing, we're using about we're increasing our brain's capacity about 7%. So that little bit of edge could be helpful for our kids to overcome dyslexic problems. In the same way with ADD. So that's why you're seeing in a lot of classrooms now, they have the standing desks. You see Vera desk every day on now. I got one of the first back when they were first coming out with the Vera desk to stand, so I stand in my office when I'm at the computer. But they're doing it in the schools, they're doing it in the high-tech industry. They've been doing it for years now. Richard Branson, for instance, in his news, you know, Richard Branson of the Virgin America, Virgin and whatever.
Aerospace.
What's that?
Virgin Aerospace.
Aerospace. There's a new big building, no chairs. No chairs in the building. Everybody stands, moves, has walking meetings because he gets more creativity, more productivity, more of these release of these neurochemicals, because when you're using more of the nerve cells, you're releasing a concentration of these neurochemicals increases. So we increase norepinephrine and dopamine really quickly. And what do our stimulants that you all use, I think, and caffeine, yes, there it is. We increase our concentrations of these major neurotransmitters that are important for attention. So exercise does it, coffee does it, cigarettes are really great at raising dopamine levels. And this relates to addiction, right? This relates to addiction. And I'll talk more about that a little bit, but it's something that exercise has been shown to help. Now, you can see, I saw it the other day, which amazed me, on TV, they were talking about ending cigarette addiction, nicotine addiction, especially with the vaping going on. And they were saying what you should do is go take a walk. And it's made it to an advertisement, which is incredible, because it early on, we knew in studies at Brown, in the UK, at various places around the world, where they were looking at addiction and exercise, they saw that this is one of the ways of promoting abstinence, helping you deal with cravings. Dopamine is all about cravings. It's all about, oh, you need more of this. This is why we reach for our cell phones. That's a huge addiction. Huge, right? And what I said early on, that going for our cell phones to look at what the latest is, whether we, you know, what I say is whether anybody still loves us, whether we're still relevant, whether there's an emergency, we get a dopamine squirt. We get this release of dopamine. Oh my God, this is what's important. And so it helps us attend. And as we increase our activity in using our brain cells, we build more neurotransmitters, we build more enzymes, we turn the genes on to make more stuff, to make more neurotransmitters and to make more receptors. And we know this very well within Parkinson's patients, that one of the treatments for Parkinson's disease today is exercise. In fact, they have, for newly diagnosed Parkinson's patients, they have boot camps for Parkinson's patients. They have special trainers around the country that are specializes in newly diagnosed Parkinson's patients in the gyms. Very popular when they open up. And also, we increase the level of serotonin, which we all know is through Prozac and Zoloft and all the other SSRIs. We know that movement, and this is sort of interesting. I showed you the mice running wheel. Well, these are rat treadmills. So, you know, we've come to that. Not only that, you know, one of the things I talked about yesterday a little bit is that We have most of the data on aerobic exercise because you can have animals run and move that way, but it's hard to get them to lift weights. It's very difficult for them to get into a yoga pose. But they now have developed a strategy, a mechanism for them to lift weights. They have the rat climb up a ladder with weights on their tail. So they're seeing this as a way to then measure the increase in their muscle mass, but also their effect on their brain. And they get smarter, just like they do if they run. Just like you put them on the treadmill or put them in that running wheel, they get smarter. They get more attentive, and so forth. But we've also learned that we're making, and this is really important, the earlier yesterday, the woman mentioned about the hippocampus, and I picked up on that yesterday too as well, because the hippocampus now is not just the center for the Grand Central Station for memory, but it also is the controller of stress, our brain's response to stress, because that's where most of the cortisol or stress hormone receptors are. And what we know is that when we make new brain cells, we make them mainly in the hippocampus. And it was thought, well, this is evolutionary, makes sense, because if we have more brain cells in our hippocampus, it's going to help us with memory. But it also helps us with stress control, because what we found just recently with Elizabeth Gould down at Princeton, basically she was saying, okay, what kind of new brain cells are we making in the hippocampus? Well, she found that many of them, when we make more new brain cells from exercising the animals, they make more GABA-containing nerve cells. 10 minutes. Okay. And GABA is, she's like GABA. She's a blocker. A major inhibitor. Because that's the GABA cells. That's what GABA does in our brain. It's the major inhibitor in our brain. Glutamate is the excitatory. GABA is the blocker. Well, more GABA cells make us more resistant to stress. So they show that the more fit you are, the more resistant to stress you are, and this might be part of the puzzle as to why. Because you have more, you've developed more blockers to stimuli that come in to say, okay, there's a threat, do something. That's where we get stressed, right? That's the beginning of stress. And then we all feel so helpless today when we can't do anything. Just like talking earlier with my friend here, that you can't do anything about what's happening in Washington. You can't do anything. So that's the toxic stress. I used to joke about George Bush, but now we got something completely different. Anyway, but if you have more inhibitors in right at the point of turning on the hypothalamus to turn on the fight or flight response in the hippocampus, you don't respond to stresses as much. So it takes more of a threat from the environment to turn the stress response on. Also, yoga increases our GABA concentration. And working with ASD kids, we use yoga when we can get them compliant. And there's all kinds of studies that have come out now. Yoga has gone mainstream. 9% of the U.S. population are in a yoga program. 9%. That's incredible. So you see certain, not just in Cambridge, not just in the West Coast. No, really. It's across the country. You see people walking with their yoga mats all the time. Yeah. And exercise raises our endorphins. As I mentioned, our endocannabinoids. So I tell kids, look, if you want to get high, go run or go swim or go cross-country skiing or do something, big exercise, and it will increase your endorphins, your morphine, your OxyContin, and your endocannabinoids and your marijuana, so you'll get high. And we know so much more about the endocannabinoids today that it has so much to do with our pleasure and so forth response. As well, more recently, we're focused on endorphins increasing oxytocin. And those of you who work with autistic kids, Asperger kids, kids in general, oxytocin is something that we know in our ASD population is low. It's not as high. And oxytocin is the bonding hormone. And when you exercise, you increase your oxytocin. So you're more liable to be altruistic. We have human studies to show this, not just animal studies. You're more liable to bond. You also send out signals that you're bondable, so that you're more loving and lovable. So when I tell teenage boys that, they love that. Also, we get information from the body coming up to the brain to help us control our response to stresses, as I mentioned, but we also get input from our bodies, and every year we have a new factor that we're seeing that are important coming up from the body to the brain. Back to the beginning of talking about this, about the beta blockers. And now, finishing up, remembering Jack, those of you who were here yesterday, I'll just go through it again. Jack is ADD because he's a Jack Russell. Developed an exercise program for him. After he exercises in the morning, he is able to take notes. If he doesn't get a chance to exercise, he gets in trouble. One of the things we know about ADD kids, you mentioned yesterday, Steve, that 2.5% more likely to be, or no, 2.5 times more likely to have substance abuse problems. Well, because we think about attention deficit and we think about low dopamine, low norepinephrine. Well, low dopamine means you're more likely to get addicted. Now, this was on the cover of Time magazine back many years ago now, when we were starting to focus on addictions in 1998. And so we know a lot about dopamine and addiction and cravings. Well, exercise improves our level of dopamine and all these other factors that I mentioned. Now, I always bring in Michael Phelps when I'm talking about ADD and addiction. Michael Phelps, you all know. Well, you don't know that he has ADD. He was diagnosed at the age of 9, put on Ritalin. His mother, the reason being is he was the Energizer Bunny in the classroom. His mother was a junior high school principal, so he was getting sent to the principal all the time at the elementary school, and that was not good. He also wasn't doing as well as he should have been doing in class. So they took him to the pediatrician, put him on Ritalin, but mom also started him swimming. Within 2 years, he was swimming 3 hours a day. They both decided that he didn't need his Ritalin anymore. And Michael went on to do Michael Phelps. We also know what happens when he stops training. He gets into his addictions. He gets into trouble. And then he has to start training all over again. And when that happens, his cravings are more under control. And he's not given to his addictive behaviors. Well, my Jack Russell also has addictions. When I'm not exercising him, he has problems stopping, chewing the Oriental rugs, barking all the time, chasing everything in the world. That's my Jack Russell. So we have to, when we exercise him, he's okay. So when I go away, used to have a dog walker who would come in with strict exercise plans for the dog. I'll pick up on Jack in a minute because I forgot about this. This is our addiction today. This is it. This is where we are. There is a city in China with 28 million people called Chongqing. It has divided the sidewalks in two. One for those who are using their devices and one for people that aren't, because they've had so many injuries, so many people walking into each other. So in this one, you're not allowed to be using your cell phone, but in this one, you know, you just go for it because you know what that's like. But this is a big city, and it's a huge problem. And so anyway, back to Jack. This one weekend I came back and the dog walker didn't show up. And this is what I came back to. So anyway, I think this is one of the many things that we can be doing to help with all the opiate crisis and all the, now soon, yes, 1 minute, fine, I'm done. Yes, I'm gonna call you GABA. I think that getting exercise and play back into our kids' lives may help in a big way to avoid trouble later on or during. And it's one of the things that a lot of our addiction centers are thankfully now going towards. It used to be you went into recovery and you spent the day in groups, which is great for once or twice during the day, but they used to spend 8 hours in groups and sit there. Now they're working in exercise programs. They're in working in movement into the recovery centers. I hold a chapter in Spark on addiction and I talk about a few of them that have been very successful, but we're working now with a lot of different groups who are interested in recovery and helping kids recover and adults. And exercise is certainly one of the tools that we know really can help forestall the cravings, addictions, and help the kids return to hopefully a somewhat normal life. So with that, I'll stop, and I have a half a minute to answer questions. Yes?
Can you comment on the difference between child-directed play and adult-directed play? There's a different benefit for each of those, and I think sometimes when we talk to parents about play, they think they need to schedule their children for lots of...
Well, now that's a very good question, because it used to be that play was so spontaneous, as the first, that one slide of the kids, you know, in the holding on for dear life, you know, it wasn't directed by an adult, and I think the creativity aspect of it is so important for our kids. They need both. They need to have directed play in a way or directed time to exercise, but they will find a way. Just like I mentioned Puno, the school, they had all these areas that they could go to, but they really wanted to be together and play games together. And so that's great. Adult-directed play, we need it, because we don't play. We've forgotten. We've lost it. So Zumba or other kinds of, you know, CrossFit or biking groups, running groups, whatever. Old people, soccer, you know, I mean, it's great. We need that. We need that because we're so play averse.
On that same theme, have you and Temple and your colleagues at Harvard or anywhere else identified the factor that I experience with exercise outside?
Yes.
Versus exercise with no sunlight?
Yes. Yes. Well, it's not just vitamin D. There's more to it than just vitamin D. There's a whole book called My Brain on Nature by two of my colleagues at Harvard, actually. And they've looked they've reviewed all the extant literature back now. It's 5 years old. The book has been out. But there's, you know, you get a lot more outside. It's like the benefits of exercise are squared when you're doing it outside in nature for lots of reasons. And I could, in my book, and Go Wild, I have a whole chapter on nature, and it's dramatic what nature does to our immune system, to recovery, to our motivation and mood. It's dramatic. And what it does, oxytocin, all the other good things that we get with exercise are even more increased in concentration. So it's a very good question.
Do we need screening for vitamin D deficiency in our adolescents with pain?
Absolutely. It should be one of your first tests, especially up here. Any place north of Atlanta will be vitamin D deficient.
No, Tallahassee, actually. That's where I first started screening adults.
Oh, really?
Yeah, really.
And you had?
20% deficiency.
Okay, but up here it's over 50%.
Yeah, thank you.
No, but you're absolutely right. We should be using, that should be part of the SMA23 I was talking about last night. How come everybody just doesn't get a screen of all these factors? We used to get thyroid and sodium and everything all at once for cheap. Now it's individual, so they can bill more, and it's awful. And it should be vitamin D. Now, I remember when I first learned about vitamin D, I went into my PC and said, can you get a vitamin D? He said, what for? This is now back 12 years ago or so. And now it's standard. You know, you get a vitamin D. It's not standard, but I mean, it's no longer abnormal.
You know, I read debates in the ACP journals about we shouldn't bother to screen for it. So there's a lot of misinformation out there.
Yeah.
Driven by cost a lot of times.
Yeah.
But even, you know, you give them the medicine, it comes up, it goes right back down again, unless it's kind of a continuous thing, and probably getting outside is better.
Right. Which is seasonal.
Yeah.
So we have a brief break, and then we start again at